From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The way the transmission of GeoTV and Airy TV were stopped last night, it has exposed the ugly face under the cover of which the government wants to snatch people's freedoms.
Press repression in Pakistan. We'll speak with journalist Mazhar Abbas, one of the heads of the two biggest Pakistan private television news channels that have been shut down. But first, deception. Pakistan, the United States, and the global nuclear weapons conspiracy. We'll look at how five U.S. administrations, from Jimmy Carter to George W. Bush, have been complicit in building and protecting Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. And we'll go to Olympia, Washington, where more than 60 people have been arrested for trying to prevent military equipment from leaving the port of Olympia. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Bangladesh, at least 3,100 people have been killed and millions made homeless following a devastating cyclone. The Bangladesh Red Crescent Society says the death toll could hit 10,000 as rescuers are still struggling to reach remote areas. Tens of thousands of homes have been swept away.
We were all taking cover inside our homes, and suddenly our house collapsed, and we were all stuck inside. Though we managed to survive, our mother did not. She was left behind inside, and we could not save her.
Thursday's storm was the most destructive cyclone to hit Bangladesh in over a decade. Scientists say Bangladesh stands to suffer even more in coming years as a result of global warming, because warmer weather patterns will produce more extreme tropical cyclones. Meanwhile, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has issued a new report warning global warming is destroying species, raising sea levels, and threatening millions of poor people. The United Nations' top scientific panel says firm action is needed to avoid more catastrophic events. The report was first published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change since it won the Nobel Peace Prize, along with Al Gore. This is IPCC Chair Rajendra Pachauri.
We are assessing science in a totally objective and neutral manner. We are not making any policy prescriptions. It's not the work of the IPCC to do so. But what we have brought out, I believe, is an extremely policy-relevant document. If this does not provide the basis for those who are responsible for forming policies all over the world on a strong scientific basis, then I'm afraid I can't think of anything more appropriate or apt than what we have produced.
In 2 weeks, the world's energy ministers will meet in Bali, Indonesia, to begin talks on creating a global climate treaty to replace the Kyoto Protocol, which expires in 2012. Here in this country, a group of environmental groups hosted the first-ever presidential forum on global warming Saturday, but in attendance were only three candidates, Senator Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, and Congressmember Dennis Kucinich. Every Democratic and Republican candidate had been invited. The forum was held 2 days after the Democratic debate on CNN in Las Vegas, which was sponsored by the coal industry. The New York Times has revealed the U.S. is proposing to start arming Pakistani tribes in an effort to fight against al-Qaeda and the Taliban. If adopted, the proposal would likely expand the presence of U.S. military troops in Pakistan and directly finance a tribal paramilitary force. The proposal is modeled in part on a similar effort by U.S. troops in Anbar province in Iraq. An estimated $350 million would be needed to train and arm the paramilitary force known as the Frontier Corps. Meanwhile, Pakistan's military leader, General Pervez Musharraf, is still refusing to lift martial law. On Saturday, he met for 2 hours with U.S. Deputy Secretary of State John Negroponte. Negroponte urged emergency rule be lifted, but also praised Musharraf for taking some steps towards democracy.
We welcome President Musharraf's announcement that elections will take place in January, a commitment he repeated to me yesterday in categorical terms. He also repeated his commitment to retire from his army post before commencing his second presidential term. And we urge him to do so as soon as possible.
While John Negroponte was in Pakistan, Musharraf ordered two Dubai-based Pakistani news channels, GOTV and RE One World, to be shut down. We'll have more on Pakistan after headlines. Israel's accusing the International Atomic Energy Agency chief, Mohammed al-Baradei, of being pro-Iranian after the IAEA issued a report that said Iran has in general been cooperating with the UN nuclear watchdog agency. The IAEA said Iran has not suspended its uranium enrichment program, but that there is no evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs, Avigdor Lieberman, said, quote, "This report is unacceptable. This is further proof of al-Baradei's one-sided and pro-Iranian position." In news from Iraq, the McClatchy newspapers report a U.S. military convoy opened fire on a column of cars Sunday morning, killing at least two Iraqi civilians in southern Iraq and igniting a new round of anger over the apparent loss of innocent life. Iraqi police charged the shootings were unprovoked and said six people, including two Iraqi policemen, died in a barrage of bullets. The attack occurred on a day when U.S. officials announced attacks in Iraq were at their lowest levels in nearly 2 years. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans blocked a Democratic bill to fund the Iraq war that would have ordered troop withdrawals begin within 30 days and set a goal of ending combat by the end of 2008. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
This bill requires the president to start bringing these troops home so that they can get the hero's welcome that they so bravely have earned. Our bill sets a reasonable goal for the end of combat operations, and it finally ensures the president will be accountable to the Congress and to the people.
The final vote on the funding bill was 53-45. The Democrats came up seven votes short of the 60 needed to advance the bill. This is Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina.
This is ridiculous. It's undercutting America's vital national security interests, and it's telling our soldiers you're losers when they're winners. So we're going to defeat it now and forever.
The number of U.S. Army soldiers going AWOL has jumped 80% since the United States invaded Iraq. Overall, about 4,700 soldiers deserted this year, a 42% jump since just 2006. The brother of State Department Inspector General Howard Krongard has resigned from the advisory board of the private military company Blackwater. Alvin Krongard resigned from Blackwater on Friday, just days after his brother, the State Department's top oversight official, was forced to admit his brother has ties to Blackwater. In news from Afghanistan, an internal UN report has concluded bodyguards protecting Afghan lawmakers fired deliberately and indiscriminately into a crowd 2 weeks ago after a suicide bombing. The report, which was obtained by the Associated Press, said as many as two-thirds of the 77 killed and more than 100 wounded were hit by gunfire. Most of the dead were schoolchildren. Over 20,000 demonstrators surrounded the Justice Department headquarters in Washington, D.C. last Friday to protest the federal government's handling of the Gina Six case and to call for increased enforcement of hate crimes legislation. The march was organized by the Reverend Al Sharpton. On Saturday, the Hip Hop Caucus organized a second demonstration against hate crimes and police violence. Earlier this month, USA Today reported the number of hate crimes being prosecuted by the Justice Department has dropped by 71% over the past decade. In New Jersey, four men protesting police brutality in Plainfield were arrested Saturday and charged with unlawful assembly. The arrest came during a protest organized by the People's Organization for Progress. A joint investigation by the Washington Post and 60 Minutes has found hundreds of defendants sitting in prisons nationwide have been convicted with the help of an FBI forensic tool that was discarded more than 2 years ago. But the FBI lab has yet to take steps to alert the affected defendants or courts, even as the window for appealing convictions is closing. The technique, known as comparative bullet-lead analysis, has been used since 1963. In 2004, however, the National Academy of Sciences concluded that variations in the manufacturing process rendered the FBI's testimony about the science unreliable and potentially misleading. The organization said that decades of FBI statements to jurors linking a particular bullet to those found in a suspect's gun or cartridge box were so overstated that such testimony should be considered misleading under federal rules of evidence. In labor news, the Hollywood and TV writers' strike has entered its 15th day. Writers went on strike November 5th after failing to reach an agreement on pay for content used in digital media. On Friday, Democratic presidential contender John Edwards joined striking writers picketing outside NBC.
Very proud to be out here today with the writers. This is a march and a fight for justice and fairness. They just want to make certain that they're able to take advantage of all the hard work and the creative work that they have provided. I mean, their products are the ones that are generating many millions of dollars for very large companies in this country. And they're like a lot of workers and a lot of union members in America. They're just looking for fairness and justice.
Negotiators for the Writers Guild of America have announced formal talks will resume next week. In Georgia, as many as 20,000 people gathered outside the gates of Port Benning this weekend to demand the closing of the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, formerly known as the School of the Americas. 11 people were arrested and charged with criminal trespass. The U.S. military uses the school to train Latin American soldiers in combat, counterinsurgency, and counter-narcotics. Frequently dubbed the School of the Assassins, critics say the school's graduates are responsible for some of the worst human rights abuses in Latin America. Protesters at the 18th annual vigil to close the SOA included Democratic presidential hopeful Dennis Kucinich. And the civil rights attorney Victor Rabinowitz has died at the age of 96. In 1937, he helped found the National Lawyers Guild. He was a longtime law partner with Leonard Boudin. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Pakistan, up to 100 people have been killed in clashes between Sunni and Shia Muslims in the country's northwestern border region with Afghanistan. While Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf continues to defend his imposition of martial law as a necessary defense against Islamic militants from the same region, U.S. military officials are reportedly considering a classified proposal to arm tribes from this area against al-Qaeda. Analysts suggest the U.S. is concerned over the rising threat of instability in nuclear-armed Pakistan and worried about the safety and security of the country's nuclear weapons. The New York Times revealed Sunday that the U.S. has been using a $100 million program to secretly help Pakistan guard its nuclear arsenal. Adrian Levy, a senior staff correspondent with The Guardian newspaper in Britain, he's the co-author of a new book on how Pakistan became a nuclear power. It's called Deception: Pakistan, the United States, and the Global Nuclear Weapons Conspiracy. It discusses how five consecutive U.S. administrations, from Jimmy Carter to George W. Bush, have been complicit in building and protecting Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. Adrian Levy joins us now from London. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's nice to be with you.
Well, let's talk about the latest New York Times revelation about the hundreds of millions of dollars that are going to the issue of nuclear weapons, they say, protecting them.
Well, I think this in itself is quite difficult to pinpoint, in as much as the Pakistanis have insisted on keeping a great opaqueness and opacity over the nuclear program, its command and control structures, and the access they've allowed is absolutely minimal, fearing that that access at some time may be turned around as targeting information either for the US or the Israelis. And so I really don't hold too much, I wouldn't really place too much on this information, you know, the great relationship between the Pakistan military and the Pentagon, for example. I would suggest that there's much that's been concealed.
Let's talk about Pakistan as a source of nuclear weapons, not only for Pakistan, but for, well, what President Bush has called countries that are part of the axis of evil. Give us a history of the nuclear weapons industry in Pakistan and how it relates to the rest of the world.
Right. I guess the obvious starting point, in essence, is over the border with Pakistan's long-term nemesis, India. And when India detonated a bomb in 1974, something it did in response to threats from China. Pakistan redoubled all of its efforts to obtain a nuclear weapons program. And a whole series of things came together. They were running a very, very dilapidated plutonium program, which was really going nowhere, tremendously costly, and had been hampered by opposition from the United States, the UK, and other powers. But come 1974-1975, a man who would become identified as the father of the Pakistan bomb program, an entrepreneur, metallurgist, and linguist called A.Q. Khan, happened to be at the right place at the right time. And he was working as a technical translator in Holland, got hold of some, very simply in fact, through dire security, some critical blueprints on a revolutionary method of using uranium to arm a nuclear device, took them back to Pakistan, and Benazir Bhutto's father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, puts him in place, and thus begins the struggle to obtain nuclear weapons. Now, up until 1979, the whole of the world, the Western world, was against Pakistan's program and did everything it could to interdict that program, fearing the instability of Pakistan, fearing a nuclear arms race between Pakistan and India. And in fact, at one point, the CIA and the Pentagon looked at sending over a team to destroy the program in a covert operation that was discussed at a meeting with General Brent Scowcroft. But come 1979, things change, and really, this will completely alter the West's attitude to the Pakistan program. In 79, of course, the Soviets invade Afghanistan, and prior to that, the US ally, the Shah, in Iran, flees, enabling Khomeini, the Ayatollah, to come back, and the CIA loses its listening stations, it loses a great ally, and suggestions are made to Carter from Zbigniew Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor, that America reconsider for the first time the gold standard of non-proliferation and shove it down the agenda in order to begin a new relationship with Pakistan that was struggling to obtain nuclear weapons. So the suggestion from Brzezinski was the beginning of turning a blind eye, let's say. But Carter runs out of steam, and it will be only Reagan, when Reagan comes in 81, that effectively can lead to this policy being implemented. And then we will see 10 years of what State Department people describe as US permissiveness, but I think what the rest of us would describe as collaboration, covertly, between the Reagan administration and the Pakistan military to cement a security relationship, enabling their nuclear program. And really, I suppose we can go back into some detail on this at a later point, but over that 10 years, the whole program would be facilitated. They would cold test a bomb, which means computer simulate one in 82. 83, they'd repeat that process. In 1984, the Chinese would take that bomb and hot test it, actually let it off in a Lop Nor test site, their Lop Nor test site. By 87, that bomb, the Pakistani bomb, had been fixed under a US-supplied F-16 fighter jet and was ready to deploy, a jet sold on the precondition that it could never be used by Pakistan for the nuclear program. And one thing to remember here is that year in, year out, throughout that chronology that I've given you, Reagan was telling the American people and Congress, Pakistan has no bomb. Pakistan cannot deploy a bomb and is not seeking a bomb. And so, you know, the ground was created for the Pakistan weapons program. But it's more overt than that, even in that there was actual direct US covert aid to that program supplied through the Pentagon. And the disruption of CIA operations to interdict the weapons program by Reagan official appointees who were working with the Pakistanis collaborating. The results in the 90s were that Pakistan did proliferate because US aid was cut off and the US turned its back on Pakistan. And the Pakistanis milked their nuclear program for hard cash, selling to Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Libya, the axis of evil powers, and we also know there is intelligence to show that they began negotiations very much with Saudi Arabia, with Syria, and of course there are tentative contacts with Al-Qaeda elements as well.
When we come back from break, Adrian Levy, I want to talk with you about what happened in 2003. When all of the blame for the proliferation to countries like Libya and North Korea and Iran and others is laid at the feet of one man, of A.Q. Khan. We're talking to Adrian Levy. He is co-author of a new book called Deception: Pakistan, the United States, and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons. We'll be back with him in a minute. The curl in the night, fighting the suns in the head. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR, and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on Channel 375 of DirecTV Link TV. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available there in Spanish. I'm Amy Goodman, our guest. We continue with Adrian Levy, the co-author of a brand-new book called Deception: Pakistan, the United States, and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons. Adrian Levy, talk about AQ Khan and how in 2003 this story unfolds.
Well, a remarkable thing has happened, and just to take you back just a tiny bit before that actual date, of course, post-2001, it became blatantly obvious to everybody that there was only one military government repressing human rights, connected tentatively to 9/11, a state sponsor of terrorism with radical connections to Al-Qaeda that was proliferating WMD. And, of course, that wasn't Iraq. It was Pakistan. And the problem facing the Bush administration was that their policy post 9/11 was very much to embrace Pakistan as an essential ally in the war on terror in order to allow the narrative over Iraq and the WMD, so-called WMD in Iraq, to rise. So 2003, as bits of news begin to leak out, news that the US has known about for years, about Pakistan's nuclear proliferation, a leak of information that happens really quite accidentally through a fairly unknown Iranian dissident group called the MEK, that holds a press conference in Washington in which it reveals that the Iranians have been developing a nuclear program, a uranium program, and it's one that's been largely constructed due to the largesse of the Pakistan military. Now, Washington's forced to react to this, and the Bush administration begins a series of fevered talks with Pervez Musharraf, the president of Pakistan, in Pakistan, and a deal is constructed. And the deal very much is to indemnify the Pakistan military, the number one ally in the war on terror, and instead of portraying these gross acts of nuclear proliferation, I mean, the most serious acts of nuclear proliferation in any of our lifetimes, instead of portraying them as the foreign policy of the Pakistan military, to reconfigure it as the crime of one rogue scientist and a band of merry men who are working with him. This deal has a quid pro quo. AQ Khan will be sacrificed along with the scientists, and in return, Pervez Musharraf will give to America intelligence on the procurement and proliferation network, will end proliferation, one should add, will be a honest and faithful security partner in the war on terror, passing back intelligence, helping with military operations in the border areas, Waziristan, South Waziristan, Northwest Frontier Province, aiding the crackdown on the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And these are the terms of the deal. So 2003 merges into January 2004. And we have AQ Khan appearing in January on, or February, I think, on the 4th, appearing on live TV, Pakistan television, a great mea culpa, taking personal responsibility for these acts of proliferation and apologising to his people, speaking in English, a speech very much aimed at the West and America. The next day he's pardoned by Pervez Musharraf, the president, and the day after that, Bush, speaking from the National Defence University in DC, congratulates Musharraf on having effectively stamped out nuclear proliferation. An extraordinary series of events leading to a deal which essentially conceals the nature of Pakistan proliferation.
And what evidence do you have that George W. Bush, that his administration and the Pakistani military concocted this cover-up?
Well, we know that, first of all, from 2001, from all the people who were helping to assemble that information in foreign governments and also within the CIA and the State Department, that a massive dossier of evidence had been gathered, very precisely linking Pakistan and the military more broadly to these acts of proliferation. The CIA itself had infiltrated elements of the Khan network, turning a European supplier, a Swiss man, who had been reporting back information on the nature of these deals, how they were put together. And, of course, remember that by 2003, you may well remember that the Libyans had given up their WMD program with the son of Gaddafi coming to London, Saif Gaddafi, and discussing some kind of a deal basically to save his father, to prevent a strike against him, which is what they feared. And the turning over of that program, as well as information gained by the IAEA in Vienna on the Iranian program, showed the way in which those deals had been put together. Now, we also got to talk to many of the European traders and the Pakistani scientists who'd been involved in those deals. And even if you followed briefly the flow of the money, it came from official government bank accounts controlled effectively by the military. These were country-to-country deals. The transports used were military transports. Some of them were done actually on Pakistan International Airways. Others were done on military transporters. And some were done on Shaheen Airways, which is a military-owned transport company. And the CIA itself had followed the movement of certain raw materials, for example, to North Korea. And in the following of those the movements, the operations were vast and they involved very often military logistics. But a final thing I think you should consider in the nature of Pakistan and the configuration of these deals is that the Khan project, the nuclear labs outside Islamabad in a place called Kahuta, they were controlled by about 20 tiers of security. You have the labs itself, the scientists working in them, and then surrounding that you have so many different intelligence organizations, military intelligence, the inter-services intelligence, which is the most notorious and pervasive in Pakistan. Then you have lines of plainclothes intelligence agencies from something called IB, Intelligence Bureau, and then you have the military lines. And everything that moves in and out has to go through a process of reporting back to the military. This was described to us by people who'd run the security at Kahuta over many years. So the idea that vast amounts of equipment or know-how, the movement of key scientists could not be known in a country dominated and controlled by the Pakistan military is laughable.
Adrian Levy, what about the United States firing intelligence agents who were uncovering Washington's complicity, purging government departments charged with tracking nuclear proliferation and tipping off the Pakistani government about probes into its illicit program?
Now, this is absolutely critical because I think that this thing that you've picked up on resonates very much in methodology to what went on pre-Iraq and during Iraq. The politicization of intelligence, the sidelining, bullying, and monstering of intelligence officials who attempted to do their jobs. And in the case of Pakistan, it was a fierce operation. One arm of government was contradicting what the other arm of government was doing. Publicly, the administrations were saying non-proliferation is a gold standard in government, and privately, they were undermining this, collaborating. Now, the CIA, elements of it, still believe that non-proliferation was a gold standard of government. And within the Bureau, looking at Pakistan, they still believe that their remit was to interdict the Pakistan nuclear program. And so we had the case of Richard Barlow, a young officer drafted in from the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency in the State Department. And by the mid-80s, mid to late 80s, he's working on the Pakistan desk within the CIA, becoming, through many citations and awards and certificates, the preeminent researcher into WMD and Pakistan. And Barlow, through his diligent research, begins to uncover considerable evidence in no distribution cables, cables submitted by officials in the State Department to their opposition cohorts in Pakistan. He begins to uncover a level of complicity, something that the State Department would call clientitis, but that the broader public would understand as collaboration, whereby information appeared to be leaked on sensitive operations. He began to dig some more. And what he discovered was that CIA operations to capture Pakistan military agents operating, buying for their WMD program in America, those operations were being blown at the last minute to the Pakistan government. One operation in particular, a sensational one, also involving US Customs Service, was completely blown. And he actually came up with the names of two presidential appointees in the State Department, both at the Assistant Secretary of State level, who were passing information to the Pakistani government to compromise these operations. He reported this. He reported also the manipulation and the politicization of intelligence that portrayed Pakistan as far much further back in the development of its program. And his reward for this was to be cold-shouldered and very much to be forced out of the CIA. But Barlow didn't give up.
Who were the top officials he reported on, Adrian? Who did this? Who tipped Pakistan off?
There's only one name that I can tell you officially. Bob Peck, who's now sadly no longer with us and was Assistant Secretary of State, was one of the two. The second I can tell you is one of America's leading, continues to be one of America's leading diplomats. But for legal reasons, we're not allowed to name him. Although there is substantial evidence to point to him, but we've been asked by our legal team not to do that today. Now, I should just add one other thing before I move on to the second phase of the monstering of Barlow, the undermining of Barlow. I should say that there are other figures and characters who recur throughout this, the other one being General Einsel, who became, under Reagan, the National Intelligence Officer for WMD. And Einsel actually, in a closed session of Congress, was openly distorting and lying about information with Pakistan in order to support the security relationship. And he would be supported by officials slightly below him within state and political appointees in the CIA in a move that one long-term State Department official described to me as making many people in the State Department deeply, deeply cynical about governments. But if we pick up with Barlow, when Barlow goes to the Pentagon to go to work for Dick Cheney, then Defense Secretary, he is tasked almost immediately with writing an intelligence estimate for Cheney to go to the president in 88, 89, looking at the state of play with Pakistan. And in his report to go to Cheney, he tells Cheney what I've told you. The entire chronology of events vis-a-vis the rise of the Pakistan program and US collaboration in it. He also makes a specific point that Pakistan is still procuring for the program and it has adapted its American-supplied F-16 fighter jets as its platform to drop a nuclear bomb. Next thing you know, literally pretty much overnight, Barlow's security clearances evaporate. A vicious whispering campaign begins in the Pentagon, accusing Barlow of being potentially a spy, a traitor, an adulterer, a drunkard. And his wife, Cindy, who's also in the CIA, is very much set against him. Now, this may sound to you remarkably like another case, the Plame Wilson case. And it's the same cast of characters who are very much involved in the periphery and centrally with Barlow's smear. It involves, once again, Louis Scooter Libby, Stephen Hadley, Paul Wolfowitz, Dick Cheney, Eric Edelman, still in the Pentagon, negotiating with Pakistan. All of these people revolving around the Barlow case, helping to spread this smear. And it really would take years until there's a triple inquiry by inspector generals for the CIA, for the State Department, and for the Pentagon that rules pretty much unanimously that Barlow was monstrously smeared, was never working against his country. And his lawyers discover that his report to Cheney had been completely rewritten, to say the exact opposite of what he'd written. That Pakistan had no bomb, was not advancing its program, could not use American F-16 jets to deploy its bomb. And the reason for that was that the Pentagon was considering, in 89-90, selling another several billions worth of F-16s to its client, Pakistan.
Adrian Levy, you have written about how President Bush and General Musharraf have been very close. And I want to wrap up with your revelation about how Pakistan has been encouraging the resurgent Taliban and al-Qaeda and continues the nuclear black market.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a very false configuration coming out of the Pentagon, which is that if Musharraf falls, you know, the Islamists will take over and have their fingers on the nuclear trigger. This is simply a false argument put out in order to continue the client status of the Pakistan military with the US military. And in fact, if you analyse Musharraf's military record and you look at his deeds rather than, you know, at the dogma, what you discover is that the Pakistan military, and Musharraf in particular, have been manipulating the Islamist faction. I mean, the military as a whole have done that since 1988, when Benazir Bhutto first came to power, setting up an Islamist coalition to attack her viciously. They repeated the same in 1990 with a slush fund of 16 million. And Musharraf himself, by 1995, reignited the Kashmir War by taking 10,000 Sunni extremists, who then set fire to the divided state of Kashmir in order to make India bleed. And that element of Islamists would join forces very much with al-Qaeda factions, with the Taliban by 2006-2007. You know, the national intelligence estimates for this and the published intelligence for this shows, both in the UK and Europe, that these factions, these Sunni militia, gave new lifeblood to the al-Qaeda remnants and to the Taliban in the Waziristan area. And the meddling would continue. You know, there were 17 banned Sunni organizations, which the US State Department proscribed, as did the Pakistan president. They were all resurgent under new names post-2005. You know, he said that he would de-radicalize society, he would help control these religious schools, which tend to prey on the poor and impoverished in the tribal areas. You know, they increased to 13,000. I mean, what we've seen is Musharraf and the military very much backing their own agenda. The agenda is to destabilize Afghanistan, to create a government there which is favorable to Islamabad. You know, and these are goals which are actually contrary to the goals of, very largely contrary to the goals of the West. And yet this is a slowly moving car crash of the US pumping billions of untraceable cash into the Pakistan military has continued since 2001. And we're left with a position where Pakistan is devoid of democracy. Democracy is weak and enfeebled. And we have just increased instability, quite honestly.
Adrian Levy, I want to thank you very much for being with us. He is co-author of a new book. It's called Deception, Pakistan, the United States, and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons. He's a senior staff correspondent with The Guardian, joining us from the Reuters studio in London. Thank you so much. As we continue on the issue of Pakistan, the first high-level visit for a U.S. official to Pakistan since General Musharraf declared emergency in early November took place Saturday. Deputy Secretary of State John Negroponte urged the general to lift emergency rule, welcomed his announcement he would hold elections in January. But Musharraf refused to say when he would lift the state of emergency. Negroponte also emphasized the importance of, quote, reconciliation between the moderate political forces. This is an excerpt of Negroponte addressing a news conference at the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad Saturday.
Reconciliation between the moderate political forces is a very desirable thing and could help set the conditions for a successful election. And now in recent days and weeks, the situation appears to have polarized somewhat. And that, of course, has had the effect of throwing the political process off track. But if steps were taken by both sides to move back towards the kinds of reconciliation discussions that they had been having previously, we think that that would be very positive and could help improve the political environment and pull the political actors back from the atmosphere of brinksmanship and confrontation that appears to have existed in recent weeks.
Deputy Secretary of State John Negroponte. Opposition leader and former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto was released from house arrest in advance of Negroponte's visit to Pakistan. As she left her home in Lahore on Saturday, she told reporters at the airport she would continue her political struggle.
Pakistan People's Party has its own viewpoint. Our agenda is purely Pakistani, and every country in the world has its own agenda. We want restoration of democracy in our country. We say that Chief of Army Staff and President Pervez Musharraf should go. If the press is under siege and judiciary is confined, then the Pakistan People's Party's viewpoint is that democracy cannot be achieved without fair elections.
Former Prime Minister Bhutto's statements came in the wake of a controversial decision by General Musharraf to shut down two of Pakistan's biggest television news channels, private ones. GeoTV and RE1 World TV were ordered Friday to halt transitions from their base in the United Arab Emirates. The continuing clampdown on the media has met with widespread protest.
The way the transmission of GeoTV and ARE-TV were stopped last night, it has exposed the ugly face under the cover of which the government wants to snatch people's freedoms. We understand that it is not only a measure against freedom of the press, but equivalent to economic murder of certain people.
Our demand, very plain and simple, we want total and complete freedom. We do not want to work under any code of conduct, under any ordinances.
Mazhar Abbas is the deputy director of RE1 World. He's also the secretary general of the Pakistan Federal Union of Journalists, leading opponent of Musharraf's attempts to silence the press, and has been a well-known champion of press freedom over the last 27 years. He joins us in the studio today. He's going to be honored by the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists tomorrow night. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Let's start off by the crackdown on your own network, on ARE and GEO. What's happened?
The latest, which I just got news from my colleagues in Pakistan, is that some kind of an agreement has been reached, and most probably both the channels will be on air shortly. And the UAE government has also played a role, and
The United Arab Emirates.
Yeah. The news which I have, I have not confirmed it from my director, but the news I have from Pakistan just now is that ARY is on air now, and Jio will shortly be on air.
ARY is your network.
Yeah. This is what, I mean, I have not seen it for myself, but the news I got from Pakistan just now is that the ARY is on air, and Jio will shortly be on air soon. And they have negotiated with the UAE officials as well as with the Pakistani officials, but none of these two channels have signed the code of conduct or given any kind of an undertaking in writing to the Pakistani officials.
I wanted to ask you about why the press is such a threat to the general, to Musharraf. In May, you were one of three journalists who received a bullet in an envelope that was taped to your car when you came out of the Karachi Press Club. You're on a hit list of who?
I don't know. I mean, this is exactly what we have been demanding. I mean, the investigation, proper investigation, who actually did this. We obviously have not, we have simply filed an FIR with the police. And we have been demanding from the government to investigate, because we are not the one who can say that who could be. You know, it's up to the government to find out, to investigate about these cases. But as far as your first part of your question concerned...
Let me ask something. Yeah, what is the Mahajir Rabita Council?
It's basically this struggle for the rights of the Mahajirs, you know. And some people said that it's one of the wing of the Mutahida Qaumi movement, the MQM. Although...
which is allied with Musharraf.
Yeah, which is an ally with Musharraf. But MQM, after issuing, when this incident took place, MQM completely disowned this, and they themselves issued a strong statement against this incident.
You've also been charged with the protesting of other independent networks when you were back in Pakistan.
Yeah, I mean, we have been struggling for this. I mean, I was really surprised when this action took place after the promulgation of emergency. It's not only the how they blocked about 45 news channels, but they issued two ordinances, one for the print media and the other for the electronic media. One for the electronic media is that they amended Pakistan Electronic Media Regulatory Authority, which regulate the TV channels. The other one is registration of printing and publication ordinance, which relates to the print media. They only issued one show cause notice to one of the newspapers to change their editorial policy. But as far as the channels are concerned, all the news channels were off air for about 10 to 15 days, and they were only allowed when they signed some of a code of conduct, except the Dawn TV news channels and Aaj TV news channels. They were on air without signing any code.
Did ARY sign this code of conduct?
The news I have that he has not signed here, the Salman Iqbal, who is the chief executive of the ARY, I have read his statement in Gulf News, and in which he said that he has convinced the Pakistani government that they have no agenda for any government for that matter, and he said that he has managed to convince the government of Pakistan that his channel should be allowed because they have no political agenda against Musharraf's government or any other government for that matter.
What has been the press relationship with Musharraf? How have they dealt with him?
I mean, before. I think the situation got bad after 9th of March, when the lawyers' movement emerged, and the kind of coverage the former Chief Justice got from the media. I mean, they were very annoyed about the live coverage of the Chief Justice for about 26 hours, live coverage of some of the TV channels, and the kind of speeches he was making. So they were really annoyed. And they even President Musharraf himself, in his speech on the 3rd of November, did mention why he was annoyed with the media. But I was surprised because that's the only point the president has, you know, in which he can take the credit for giving so much freedom to the electronic media. And when the government was completing its tenure, they withdraw all this credit. They withdraw all this liberty to the media, which was really surprising. And secondly, they themselves violated their own laws, you know, under which a channel can be put off air. There's a law defined in their own laws. You know, there are clauses in which it said that you can't do this without issuing a show cause notice and without giving reasons in writing, you know, that these are the reasons why we are taking action against certain channels.
The images of the journalists being beaten in the streets, is this new?
Not really. I mean, in the 70s, in the late 70s, the journalists were even flogged in Pakistan. You know, three journalists were flogged, and some 400 journalists went to jail. And that was, I believe, still the worst period in Pakistan's history as far as the curbs on the media is concerned. You know, the era of General Ziaul-Haq was the worst for the media.
General Ziaul-Haq.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. It's the worst because during that period, journalists were convicted by the military courts. Three of them were flogged, and just because they were raising voice against the ban on a newspaper, on the opposition newspaper. And during the last 5 years, there have not been so many actions against the press, against the media, but the incidents of violence have increased. Some 24 journalists had been killed during the last 7 years. Some 100 cases of violence against journalists had been reported. Even the families of the journalists were targeted. I mean, recently, here, a few days back, one of the journalists who was killed, Hayatullah Khan, in the tribal areas in Wana, his wife was killed about 2 days back.
Are you concerned for your own safety when you return now?
I'm not really concerned. I still believe that, you know, Pakistani media, if you compare to anywhere in the Muslim world, Pakistani media is still very vibrant. You can still see a lot of criticism on the government in the newspapers. I mean, press is still much freer as compared to anywhere in the Muslim world. I mean, Pakistan is the only country. There are problems. Yes, there are serious problems. But I still believe that I don't know whether due to recent protests, they take action against me or not. But I still believe that Pakistan is the only country in the Muslim world where media is relatively much freer than anywhere else.
We're going to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Mazhar Abbas is the deputy director of ARY One World Television that has just been shut down. But he says, according to his latest news, is it's going to reopen. He will be awarded by the Committee to Protect Journalists on Tuesday night. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Olympia, Washington, to talk about the major protests there against military weapons. Stay with us.
Miles to Baghdad. What have I become? New York's got snow in April, and I can't locate the sun. Tie yellow ribbon around something. Your guns and tie yellow ribbon around something, something good.
Lizzie West and the White Buffalo, 19 miles to Baghdad, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 400 anti-war protesters marched through Olympia, Washington, Saturday to protest the war in Iraq and police brutality aimed at demonstrators in the past 2 weeks. Police beat back and repeatedly used pepper spray on peaceful protesters who were trying to stop military shipments to and from Iraq in the port of Olympia. At least 66 people have been arrested, 150 others badly injured since the protests began November 7th. On Saturday, demonstrators used nonviolent direct action to block military equipment for 17 hours, forced a convoy back into the port. Olympia Port Militarization Resistance is a group that was formed in 2006 by community peace activists. They wanted to, quote, end their participation in the illegal occupation of Iraq by stopping the military use of the port of Olympia. Fan Nguyen is a member of Olympia Port Militarization Resistance, works as an IT specialist. He was arrested after participating in the nonviolent protest in the port of Olympia in November 2006 and the port of Tacoma in March of 2007. Fan Nguyen joins us now from Seattle, Washington. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Tell us what you've been doing and your group in the port of Olympia.
Thanks, Amy. What we've been doing is this has started since May of 2006, in which the community has responded to the military's use of our port as a pretty much a revolving door for war operations in Iraq. They have been using the port to ship Stryker vehicles to and from Iraq through the port of Olympia, and we decided enough is enough. We're not going to stand for it. We're not going to tolerate it. We have the power to do something about it, and, you know, we're just going to implement it. That's what the Port Militarization Resistance, or PMR, is all about. It's about the local residents taking action and understanding that there are so many ways to challenge war, and occupation, and we're going to explore every single way, and we're going to get it done.
Well, the latest action in this last 2 weeks, first was a Stryker vehicle. Explain what that does. Now, that wasn't going to Iraq, but coming from Iraq, going over to Fort Lewis. Is that right?
That's correct. These are Stryker vehicles from the 3rd Brigade, 3rd Stryker Brigade, 2nd Combat Infantry Division. They had actually left Olympia in May of 2006, and when they had went on their way out, we had actually blockaded them because we did not want to send them to Iraq. They were being sent in advance of the 3rd Stryker Brigade soldiers being sent to Iraq, and we were hoping by stopping the Stryker vehicles from reaching Iraq, we would prevent the deployment of the 3rd Brigade soldiers. Now, the 3rd Brigade has since returned, minus 48 soldiers who were killed in Iraq, and who knows how many Iraqis were killed as a result of the 3rd Brigade's deployment. Now that they've returned, their equipment is returning as well. And we are saying, no, we don't want the equipment to be returned only to be fixed and then shipped back to Iraq for further use. It needs to end now. And we understand that the road to Iraq goes through the port of Olympia. And at that point, we decided we're going to block it again. This time, we're going to contain the vehicles, keep it from being sent to Fort Lewis, keep it from being used again. And that's what we started doing a couple of weeks ago when this all began, when the ship arrived on Monday, November 5th. And so what we ended up doing was creating blockades. We, as you had mentioned, we reclaimed our own port for 17 hours on November 9th, and again on November 13th. This is our port, and we're going to take control of it. We started, we actually were able to stop military shipments coming out of the port while allowing civilian shipments to leave and or enter the port. As well, on November 13th, there was a really powerful women's solidarity action in which 39 women were arrested blockading the port, showing solidarity with the women of Iraq and showing their own strong solidarity. This is the community in action. Other communities can follow our lead and do the same thing. We understand that it is possible, and it just was far more successful beyond what we could have envisioned. As long as you know that you can do this, as long as you know it is possible, then, you know, it's all yours. This is our community.
Fun, when we were just showing images of the police pepper spraying protesters, and for our radio listeners, you can see the images at our website, democracynow.org. Can you describe the police response to this protest?
Well, initially, the Olympia Police Department decided that it would be more expedient not to arrest protesters. So instead, they used all sorts of weapons against us. They used batons, beanbag rounds, pepper spray, pepper ball rounds, tear gas, concussion grenades, and stinger balls. All of this because they felt that we who were acting nonviolently, who did not pose a threat to the police, somehow they needed to get us out of the way without arresting us. And so they used all these tactics, which are going to come back to them. They're going to be held accountable for this. They are enabling the war and occupation to continue. And through their actions, which are just so heavy-handed, you know, bystanders were also beaten. Bystanders were pepper sprayed. It was just ridiculous. The police were out of control. And all of this in order to support this war and occupation, which the community has come together to say no to.
At this point, how many people have been arrested? And also, what has been the response of the Olympia community?
At this point, there have been 66 arrests altogether. The shipments have, for the most part, ended. And so, yeah, there's been 66 arrests. The response to the community, well, last Saturday, following the conclusion of the shipment of vehicles from the Port of Olympia, we had a rally in support of the port protesters. And there were over 400 people there showing their support, people from all around the community. There's been so much amazing solidarity in the Northwest. People from Port Townsend, Washington, all the way to Portland, Oregon came to show their support, solidarity, and join us, join this little community in resisting the war. And so it's just been great.
Fun Wen, what are your plans now?
Our plans are to continue. We want to help other people, assist other people in resisting the militarization of their ports. And we also encourage other communities to look around and just see what all the possibilities are and understand that they are capable of doing this. You know, last year when this started, all it was one person trying to lock the gates of the port and another person walking in front of a Stryker convoy. This time around, what we saw were hundreds of people chasing after these exact same Stryker convoys through the streets of downtown Olympia. It is possible. This is our community. This is our town. We're going to reclaim it, and we're going to say no to war and occupation.
Fan Wen, I want to thank you very much for being with us, joining us from a Seattle studio, but based in living in Olympia, Washington, the capital of Washington state. Fan Wen is with the Olympia Port Militarization Resistance Project. Thank you for being there. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shrufa Dokadus, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Hugh Grant, Samantha Chambly, John Randolph, Laura Chipley, Ra Kampeni, Vesta Godars. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.